and welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, we have the president of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, Michael Quaranta, here. Welcome back.
Thanks very much, Laura. It's great to be with you.
It's been a year since you were here, but unfortunately, I think the last time we spoke, we were in what we would call a year. And so I don't even know. Do you want to start with COVID and the issues that it's brought to the business table here in this state?
Sure. I think at this point, the listeners are quite familiar. I mean, we know that we've got a lot of hiccups in supply chain, and those continue. We've got relatively low unemployment, but nationwide, we have 3.7 million jobs beyond the unemployment figures. Said differently, if everybody that was unemployed went to work, you'd have 3.7 million job vacancies in this country. So we really need to tackle nationally our immigration policy. The hospitality industry really was devastated and hit the hardest. Retail has had a very uneven experience and a really challenging time as well. Any kind of consumer-facing business, especially if you have brick and mortar, it's been a real challenge. Manufacturing, other than supply chain issues, other businesses haven't really kind of taken their foot off the gas. And the last that I'll mention is healthcare, which is greatly stressed and is going to have long-term staffing challenges going forward.
Let's get started then with a quick overview of what exactly the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce is and its mission.
Sure. Great. We have we've been around for 185 years and are the voice of business in the state of Delaware. We have really two goals. We advocate on behalf of the business community, and we provide opportunities for business leaders to meet other business leaders. On the advocacy piece, we have a series of proposals that we support, that we advocate for, that are both legislative and regulatory, things that matter to businesses. And then on the networking side, we host a series of events. Our big annual dinner will be April of this year. It was delayed a couple months because of the current virus.
Let's look at the state then. You've been around 180 plus years. How is Delaware for business? Are we a welcoming state? I know that tax-wise, for years, we were, we were the gold standard for drawing in the big corporations. But how do we really rate now compared to our neighbors, especially Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland? Are we a business-friendly state?
We are a very good destination, but we could be better. We've got a lot of proposals before the General Assembly this year, which, frankly, take us the wrong direction. They're all well-intentioned, but they come at a time when it's really, really challenging for businesses to be in business. A lot of this is on the human resources side. And so but let's unpack something that you said. You know, Delaware has always been a destination because it's, regionally focused in a really, really strategic place. And that is never going to go away. But Delaware also gets over a third of its operating revenue for its state government from outside of its boundaries because of its incorporation court, the Court of Chancery, which means for everybody else, there's a lot of businesses around the country that aren't here, but they incorporate in Delaware because of the Court of Chancery and the legal certainty that comes that if they ever were taken to court, that they have got a pretty friendly place to land should they be challenged in court on any particular topic. So if they pay an annual fee to the state for that benefit, and that accounts for about one-third of the revenues that go into the state every year for its operating budget.
Does that mean that they are focused on these absentee taxpayers? Are they benefiting them at the expense of the local or the brick-and-mortar businesses?
No, everybody actually benefits equally, to be very truthful. It's just that the and actually we as residents are the greatest beneficiary. The reason why we don't have a sales tax in this state is because one-third of our revenue comes from outside of the state's boundaries and is paid by people who don't live or work here.
Let's talk about who is a member of the chamber, because you're here for the guy or gal who just starts up a business because they're out of work right now and they decide that they are an entrepreneur, to maybe a business or a service that has been established for 200 years, that's always been here and has maybe multiple locations, or maybe even is a Fortune 500 company at this time.
So we provide an awful lot for everybody, and it comes down to one. Obviously, I talked about it, and it kind of goes back to our mission and our goals. We provide networking opportunities. We provide a lot of rich content together to help businesses of all sizes understand what to do with the current pandemic that we're in. How do I reorganize my office or my retail shop in order to be safe and provide a safe environment for my customers? We've touched on a lot of those different topics, general economy topics. We've had the governor. We've had some of the epidemiologists from the different hospitals in to kind of talk about where we're at and what we can plan for. And we've had people who design office space to help our businesses think through some of the modifications that could make to their existing space to provide that kind of safe environment and everything in between. So, you know, it is, and that applies to large businesses, small businesses of any size or any industry. So there's the events and the networking. It all goes together, Laura, and they find that of great value.
There are challenges before COVID. The business scene had been drastically changing over the last few years anyway. And I'm talking about internet sales and the global economy. It's playing such a big part now in how the common consumer thinks. We no longer look for a furnace repair company or buy a book. We don't do anything the way that we did 5 years ago. And have you had to change your education or your approach to businesses? How have you helped prepare them for the new world beyond COVID?
Sure. So, you know, leaders lead. And so we've tried to put our best foot forward on our footprint on social media and communicating and providing rich content that I talked about. But how we deliver that has been in large part through virtual webinars. So there's a lot of different ways in which people can get information now and or, as you point out, shop, buy things, et cetera. So businesses have had to pivot. So let's take a look at what's the intersection of those two and what would be a great example. And one of them would be maybe telemedicine. You know, that had been a discussion in this country for decades. And then with the onset of COVID, regulations and policies were changed pretty quickly in order so that people could have a communication with their nurse practitioner or their doctor from afar without having to leave their home. It was safer to keep them where they were and use their phone or some electronic device to get the care that they needed. And in many cases, that's satisfactory. In other cases, sure, people still need to be seen, but for a lot of routine stuff, there's an example of how technology and change was forced upon us given the course of events, but it all worked out to everybody's advantage.
Just before the show began, we were chatting, and I said, now be careful what you tell me, because I'm not going to remember when we discussed it. But I brought up that at the same time, you're able to move a mountain there, but then Ready in Six is a campaign, a program that you've been researching and working on and white papering for several years now. And that harkens back to what I was asking, are we a business-friendly state?
Yeah, so for the listeners, let's go back and talk about what Ready in Six is. We hosted a conference back in the summer of early fall of 2018, and we brought in some outside site selectors who are the kinds of people who businesses go to when they say, hey, I want to land my business in the mid-Atlantic. Help me find which state. Interestingly, they may be site selectors, but they're really site eliminators. So they actually we brought some of those people in, sat them down with the governor and said, so how are we doing? And they looked at the governor and said, not very well. You could be better. You can't be small and slow when you make decisions. That's not a recipe for success. So that led to, hey, we've got to be able to make decisions both on sites and regulations in terms of where you can put an entrance, fire marshal requirements. Nobody wants to put public health or safety at risk, but we have to be able to make these decisions in a timely manner because our competition is doing similarly. So the Ready in Six initiative, we really focused on DelDOT and DENREC. Jennifer Cohen, when she was still the secretary, and she's, of course, moved on, really did a really nice job in getting a lot of different dashboards created and information, and kind of started to turn the culture at DelDOT to make it so that they could evolve into making decisions in a speedier fashion. We haven't had that kind of success with DENREC. Now, in fairness to all the above, they also have a combination of federal money and federal regulations that gets commingled. So it's a complicated problem, and we're going to be at this for a very long time. We do need more time and attention by the folks at DENREC. Again, same decisions that could be made, Laura, in 18 days shouldn't take 18 months, and that's the goal. The outcome is going to be the same.
When I hear about conflicts or problems between departments or regulators, I always think, well, it's a county versus a township versus the state. And then you introduce the feds as well in that. And now probably getting this a little bit out of order, but since we're talking about sites right now, we got some problems here in this state with climate change. And mm-hmm. we've got weather that is banging you on the head right now, too. Are you addressing that? Is that part of your advocacy work? Because that's going to affect a lot of employers.
So, it's an interesting topic. And I actually have a view from a couple perspectives. I think, in my full-time job is, as you said, president of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, but I also serve, and I'm privileged to serve as mayor of the city of Newcastle. And we are one of the lowest by elevation standards, lowest locations on the Delaware River in the state of Delaware. So climate matters. This is something, though, that while businesses and industries are forever trying to be faster, smarter, pollute less, I mean, we're all in this together, right? But we can't do this alone. We can't, the whole country has to, we can't be doing something terrific and be on the leading edge in New Jersey or a surrounding state not be doing their part as well. And similarly, that's got to be the case with all other countries too. So, and that's a challenge. How you actually get there matters. So for state chamber members, our goal is to be a facilitator in these kinds of conversations. We're not going to be the solution. Our members will provide that kind of insight and that kind of solution. We have an environmental committee that is in regular communication with one another and also with DENREC and our regional EPA leaders. So it's from those kinds of conversations that we, again, want to do the right thing because we all are breathing the same air and drinking the same water.
Dima comes in and gives me updates every so often. And the last time we chatted, he said that, well, of course, that's part of their charge is to get business back as fast as possible. That's most of the recovery work that they try to do is get businesses back in there. And the weather has just wreaked havoc on a lot of our communities these last couple of years.
It's a challenge for sure, and it's an ongoing challenge. And so, the planet's evolving and businesses and technology will continue to evolve too. And I have every confidence that we will make really smart decisions moving forward.
Well, I got off on the economic development side here of your advocacy work. But if you'd like to learn more about the programming and all the things that are offered by the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, they're easy to find online at dscc.com, dscc.com. This is Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and today we are talking to the president of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, Michael Quaranta, also the mayor of Newcastle. But today we're talking about business. And one of the things that came up in our conversation before, and you've alluded to it a couple of times now, and I've heard this from other organizations, Delaware and its workforce. And I know this is probably a national issue, but are we producing the workers that we need?
So there's a real mismatch, and it's only going to be the disruptions and the changes are going to come more regularly, more frequently. I think we have seen the last of the days where you take on a particular job and, that's what you're going to do for 40 or 45 years and then call it a day. So this is our number one priority. And a couple of data points I think are really important for our neighbors and your listeners to understand. 3% of the workforce exits a high school or college every year. 97% of the folks that need to be upskilled or perhaps need a refresh or a new direction are already in the workforce. And that's the 30 or 40, maybe even the 50-year-olds that are out there working. Technology is always going to evolve, and things that happen in Shanghai aren't going to be discovered here in Smyrna, 2 years later. It's going to be maybe 2 hours later. So adaptability by the workforce is going to require a lot of nimbleness by the training community. And so there's going to have to be a better connection. And I know the Delaware State Workforce Development Board is hard at this task. Real-time communication between Delaware employers up and down the state into the training, into the workforce training and skills infrastructure in the state, so that we can have the right kinds of folks with the right kind of skills in real time. And so that may be a 3-hour certificate program. It might be a 30-day or 3-month endeavor. It might be a year or two, but a lot of things are going to change. I mean, look at technology and look at the way technology has changed every single job. Yes, there are people that build hardware, make software, make applications that are on our devices, protect us from attacks, cybersecurity. And that's a competency that is at our hospitals, it's in our banks, it's in our retail stores. Tech is everywhere. And so we can't get enough people that have that kind of those kinds of skills and those kinds of backgrounds, and it's constantly changing.
You mentioned telehealth just a little bit ago, and I know that the healthcare industry is suffering greatly. But who's hurting the most, and who are we missing in the workforce?
Well, that's a great question, Laura, and it's kind of all over the place. I mean, so healthcare. We've always had shortages and challenges, and now these are more acute because people are burned out and or maybe going to exit the profession. Similarly, manufacturing. I know that people think, well, Delaware had its heyday in manufacturing years ago. That's because there were a couple of well-branded, big auto working facilities that were here. Delaware manufacturing is growing. And leaps and bounds, and it is a strong sector in this state, and there are great opportunities. And parents with younger kids, I know that I'm of the generation where everybody was told to go to college. Now you have options, and you have incredible options that are in front of you in the manufacturing sector that may not require a degree. A degree still has value; it's got terrific value, but there are now lots of opportunities in the manufacturing sector, and it's a growing sector here in the state. So there are the workforce challenges are going to continue. They're going to be something that people who are entering the workforce now, or if you're in the earlier half of your career, you're going to have to continue to refresh and maybe even remake yourself in order to be relevant and be rewarded financially for all those challenges that you take on.
I hate to bring up the idea of wages at this point, but that is part of your advocacy programming. Mm-hmm. Getting people to do these jobs is, contingent on the benefit and the wage that you get. So what are you proposing? What are you working on? What are you talking to our officials on this?
So that's a complicated question because there's so many different pieces to that puzzle. But the key components are obviously wages, right? People want to make more money. Okay, well, that's great. But requiring in law that people make more money for the same job that they used to do, and I'm referring to the increase in minimum wage to $15 an hour, has backfired, and it will continue to backfire in a couple of ways. One, because you have people who've exited those jobs, and it forces the hand of automation to be adapted and adopted faster. And unless people who were in those jobs go find themselves into skills training for in-demand work, they're going to be underemployed or unemployable for longer stretches of time. It actually, those kinds of artificial changes really don't help the very people that they're intended to help. It actually backfires. Because take a look at where we're at right now. So we had all this great push to increase wages. Well, wages went up a small percentage last year. Inflation in December was 7%. So people actually have less. Now, you could argue that, okay, well, they would have even less money had the wages not gone up. And that would be a fair point to make. But it is the people who have the least of the skills among us who need to be trained, and or if they're mid-career, they need to be upskilled because they can make higher wages because there are great jobs out there waiting for them, as opposed to our policy leaders making decisions that push those wages artificially because it actually has a net negative effect.
But these minimum wage jobs tend to be temporary types of jobs. They don't lead to that next level. And also, they are an entry-level job, too. Even if they do lead to another level, somebody's going to leave them, whether because the job ends or because they do move on. Who's going to take those jobs?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, so the answer has historically been those are the first jobs that get automated, and they are eliminated, right? I mean, think of your experience if you walked into a large retail store without naming names. And if you think about maybe 10 years ago, there was one or two self-checkout machines. Now there might be 20 self-checkout machines and only one that's actually staffed, right? So the adoption of the technology has kind of pushed all those jobs aside. You go in and order a sandwich. You put all your requirements on a screen. You'd be able to swipe a card and pay for your sandwich right there too. There go a couple of other low-skill, low-wage jobs. So technology is going to continue to eliminate those things that are the easiest to swap from a person to a machine, okay? But the good news is someone's got to manage the technology, right? So someone has to manage all of that, and so there are always going to be a role. There's a role for people, but you can't just enter the workforce with limited or no skills. The other problem with artificial wage increases is this. Laura, if my choice, if you were looking for a side gig and I was going to interview you as opposed to a well-meaning kid at McCain High School, for example, I'm choosing you. You have a work history. You've got experience. And so that now because the wage is such that you might be interested in taking on a few hours a day here or there, I'm going to give you that opportunity because I've got, frankly, more faith and trust because you've got that background in history. And so this doesn't help our young people obtain the entry-level jobs that many of us had years ago that kind of got us prepared for the workforce. Finally, let me say something about retail. Retail has always been, in this country, a destination, especially for immigrants. And there's a lot of good retail jobs, and there's a lot of good retail training. You learn a lot of durable skills when you have to deal with the public. And dealing with customer service, selling, managing people, there's an awful lot that goes to that. And so immigration policy, we talked about that earlier, is really important because it'll help populate that sector, in which has had a history, a very rich history, of being the destination place for a lot of people who first entered this country for their first job.
As we have an aging population as well, are we losing people? Do we need immigration to fulfill the ranks of workers, especially each year as more and more people are leaving the workforce?
So, again,
and this is on all levels, not just in retail, but
sure.
You know, for everybody who leaves retail, there's somebody who also retires from that nursing or a research job and teaching. You know, all of that.
Yeah, fair point. So, you know, a couple things we have to think about with our seniors in particular. We know that we have a great many people. About half the population is underprepared for retirement. So. It's high time that we actually look at our Social Security laws and provide people with an opportunity. Many are going to have to work for a very long time after their Social Security benefits kick in. We don't want them to be disincentivized or have any financial barriers because of the amount of money that they can make while they're receiving their benefit. You know, that program was set up, you know, decades ago, and that's an issue that needs to be adjusted, I think, based upon the realities of today. There's going to be, you know, I'm part of the baby boom generation. And so, look, there, you know, we always knew the great retirement was coming for a huge group of people. And as you correctly point out, it's not just somebody who was working a low-skill, low-wage job. It's also people in different professions and everybody in between, manufacturing, retail, you name it. And so there's great opportunities. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, it's a real challenge for employers, but the great opportunity for people who are still of working age is as people of age retire, it's opening the door for upward mobility.
In our waning moments, we've been talking about your 2022 priorities, and we've talked a little bit about the workforce and the environment and development here, but fiscal policy, the one-time spends, is Delaware getting its piece, and are we planning well to for 2032?
So, really great question. The state has never, ever had these kinds of revenues in its coffers, ever. I think, as you know, back from 2003 to 2010, I was former Delaware Congressman's Mike Castle's chief of staff. And when he was governor, he, in his last year being governor, I think it was 1992, the budget for the very first time in Delaware hit $1 billion. Today, it's times five that. And the amount of money that's come in from the federal government has plussed that up substantially. The state has never seen this kind of money ever. There are great opportunities that can change generations in the orbit that they're on if invested wisely. And in a hat tip and a positive acknowledgement to Governor Carney, he's put a lot of money aside for workforce training and development, investing in people. How do we rebuild the middle class? You know, that's a huge priority. So human capital, investments in human capital, will be a very durable investment and one that keeps us going for decades. There are also projects. You know, there are water systems. There are electric grid improvements, broadband. There's an awful lot of infrastructure that needs updating and repair, but this is how it all gets connected, Laura. We need people in the building trades. There are huge deficits in the building trades: plumbers, electricians, carpenters, welders, etc. Why? We spent 40 years telling everybody to go to college. There are great opportunities in those particular trades, and we need to loosen up the requirements that it takes for people to enter those skills, those skilled trades, and become a productive part of the workforce.
If we want to learn more about your priorities and the advocacy work of the chamber, we go to your website, or how does someone who is not a business person interact with you?
They're welcome to reach out. They're welcome to engage us on social media, or again, take a look at our information that's on our website. You know, we have, unlike a lot of other states, we actually have three very interesting pieces to our puzzle. Not only are we an affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, we are also the Delaware Manufacturing Association. So we're affiliated with the National Association of Manufacturers. And we're also the Delaware Retail Council. And we're affiliated with the National Retail Federation. Also, all three of those entities are headquartered in Washington. In other states, those would be three separate state associations, but we roll all that up under one. So we've got our fingers in a lot of pies, and it's interesting work for sure, and it's complicated, but we're on it and at it.
And, of course, learn more at dscc.com for Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, dscc.com. Michael, always interesting, always fascinating. You bring up amazing points that I hadn't thought of about our economy and about our state.
Well, I appreciate it, Laura, and thanks for the opportunity.
My guest today, the president of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, Michael Quaranta. And again, for more information, go to dscc.com. Michael, you're welcome back again, obviously. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.